herd ran in fear. And the Dark Ones, children of the Worm, walked the streets in the day. I turned my head from the sight. The Phoenix told me, "This is as it shall be, but not as it should." The Phoenix left me then. Now I cannot dream. I can only remember the signs, each one in perfect detail. These are the last days. May Gaia have mercy on us.
25 years of Vampire the Masquerade presents Werewolf the Apocalypse, a review podcast.
All right. Yeah. So here's the story about the greatest cat I've ever encountered, right? I was living with a friend, two friends, right? They were both engaged to be married, and they had three cats. And there was this one cat named Shadow that was the coolest cat you've ever met. He was always chill. He was a good hunter, so he kept like the house and like the surrounding woods free of mice, right? And he was just the coolest thing. Like I lived in the basement. He would come down and like just sleep with me like during the mornings, right? Like so cool. Except when you gave him catnip. When you gave him catnip, he turned into a psychopath. I remember the first time that ever happened. Like I think I had spilled the catnip like on the ground, and he just like shoving his face in it and like rolling around. And then I remember he turned and looked at me, and he had like those giant like crack eyes on. I was like, Shadow, are you okay? And then it was the weirdest thing. He slowly started like climbing up the side of the couch. Right, like you'd see in like a monster horror movie. I was like, Shadow,
slowly coming to you, right?
Yeah, I was like, Shadow, what are you doing? The ears are back. He was pissed, and I was like, I have no idea what's happening. And that cat fucking chased me out of the house. I'm not proud to say it. But yeah, I never gave him catnip after that.
So if you guys are just tuning in, what we're talking about here is that I hate cats. I think that's official. And I don't hate cats. We have, if you're not a cat person, whatever. You're still hearing this. It's entertaining. I lovingly, with my new bride here, we have two Singapore cats. They're very beautiful cats. They're like little lions. And they're of that age. We got to get them, well, neutered. And one of them, we really knew we did, because he started to get that fluffy fur and meowing at doors where he believes he's catcalling. He's looking for, you know, some fine young females to make more Singapore cats with. Making all sorts of noises. He bit me in the face.
Ooh.
This cat has an acclaim where he clawed my balls. That's happened. So you may be wondering about this story. Nothing weird. Everyone thinks it's cute that your cute pets climb into bed, except when you're sleeping and you're Bob and you don't wake up in time to anything. Like, I'm normally a light sleeper, and I didn't feel this cat. He likes warm places, so where do you go? It's warmest where your crotch is, because you're covered in a blanket forever and a day. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, up by your neck where you have the pillow and you're there and, you know, whatever. Typically, he's a pillow hugger, boring you to death. I didn't feel him go down by my legs. So when I suddenly was startled awake because I felt something wet, which was his nose on my inner thigh, I didn't know why. I tensed up, and I tensed up, he clawed. He did the fighting cat bing bag swaps.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Where it's like fucking bing, 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 and it took off. I was like, motherfuck! Right? I'm like holding him. I'm like, God. So I get, and then the whole time she's like, aren't they lovely? And I'm like, well, she didn't sound like that, but you know, it's still like she said that. I'm like, they're cute, I guess. And I'm sitting there like, don't kill the small animal. Don't kill the small animal. Right. But we both thought, well, once he gets neutered, that'll calm down.
Yeah. How'd that turn out?
What we didn't account for is the story you just told about old young Shadow. Perfectly fine until he gets catnip.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where cats go when they're stoned, but you're fucked. When they get there, you're done because you're stupid. You're like, oh, loving little dude, it's no big deal. Moa comes home with the cat here because with COVID we could only have one owner.
Mm-hmm.
To the place to see it to and fro. She went, comes back mainly because she could probably read the signs. It's probably helpful because yeah. You know, it's Sweden. I don't read the language yet. So he comes in. I think he's fine.
Mm-hmm.
He's like sitting there like, oh, meow, meow, everything's cool. And then he just looks at my foot for a second. I'm like, what is he doing? And he slides across the floor on his stomach, swatting at nothing, gets to my foot, grips it, and bites through the sock as hard as he can. Like, wow. I'm like, what the? And she's like, oh, you know, he's high. He's a little high. That's not high. And he's zipping through the house like a crackhead. Like, you know, I mean, like, I don't know necessarily, you know what I mean? The energy of one, like, he's a super addicted, over the top, bounce on everything. His little brother, who's normally an energy ball, shrinked away and hopped up on the couch by me. He doesn't like anybody touching him. And when he leaned his head against me, he was like, that's my bro. Oh, I don't want to play today, Bob. I'm like, that's all right, little man. I helped put him up in his treehouse. He's been there all day staring at his brother, playing with nothing. Like all the cat toys that are down there, the little brother was playing with them. This big guy's diving at nothing and swatting at thin air most of the time. And I'm like, he must have saw the toy and it's like delayed in his brain. I don't know what's going on. The coup de grace was when it's you know, feeds him. Cat loves her, like obsessively so. She goes to pick him up. I see him bite her hand. And she's like, he didn't bite me. I'm like, he fucking bit you. I just saw him bite you. You just don't want to say nothing. And then she goes to lie down and take a nap. And she goes, I'm going to take a nap, but I want him to be out here. And she tosses him out and shuts the door. So she goes to take a nap. I'm like, uh-huh. Yeah, you too see the wrath of this crackhead zooming around. So I was like, yeah, you know, I thought that was too funny. I'm glad you had a catnip story because... Nothing we're about to talk about this book has anything to do about cats.
Not a thing.
Not a single thing. Want everybody to know that. We killed time talking about cats because, surprise, we like y'all. Thought you might like that little bit of humor. We thought it was funny. Haven't talked in a bit, so we just sharing. Yeah, so,
I know it's funny.
shared with y'all. Raids across Australia. I want to tune in a little better than that. I know we didn't do the intro typical because I like coming in with some side talk. A lot of times we get to talking before the podcast. We record some good stuff. We just don't release it because back in the day it was like the professional timing of it all and blah, blah, blah. Folks, we're human and we're your friends too. So we just like to get at it. And of course, this is me. I'm Bob and we're here with Brentron. How you doing, Brentron?
Hey, Bob. Hey, everyone.
And again, like I said, we're going over Raids Across Australia, and I did that again, just so you know, we're trying to recover. And because Raids Across Australia is a tough book, folks, I'm going to tell you that right now. It's the toughest book I've come across in First Ed Werewolf right now, where there's a lot of potential, it just seems like it wasn't utilized.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
And what I mean is that in Werewolf 20, you can kind of see where some of these stories... First Ed on up were salvageable or seeded through or mentions and Easter eggs were used, and that's okay. And then some of them out of this Australia book, you're like, I get why that wasn't touched again for a lot of reasons. Now, we'll just get into this. I mean, you guys don't have to agree, and fundamentally, I hope you disagree. I hope someone, you know, super history major loves Australia so much that they're just willing to champion a fight out of us here, but... we're not saying it's bad. What we're saying is we don't understand some parts. Mm-hmm. Now, as the opening story goes, this is the best thing in this book. Tethering everything to the werewolf universe to date, I'd say the opening story is the best.
I'd agree with that. I would.
That we've had. Right? I enjoyed the Black Sparrow Dancer story that you had there about, you know, the warning of the BSDs that you had that we talked about previously. This beat it. This theme goes through in-depth detail, right? The opening story starts to talk about how at a guru moot, they make you feel that you're watching this moot, that you're in the crowd at this moot, how they're using blood to dry feathers to certain parts of their body to enhance the roles they're about to play. They kind of broaden the theme that when the guru tells a story, it's not just sit around and hear a story. There are members who have to act out parts of the story, do it with such a talent as the theatrics relive and reenact the story. So they go for immersion and memorabilia is not the term I want to use, but remembrance. Remembrance is the term I want to use. That sticks in your mind, right? This story. And they paint a picture of how to do it. This story talks about a red talon. And before I dive into that, I'm going to warn you, I'm abbreviating it on purpose. I don't want to ruin your full descriptors and everything that the author put into it, because the story is that compelling that everyone right now should read it. Mm-hmm. Stop listening. If you have that, take it off your shelf. If you haven't read it in a while, go back and reread it. I've read this book before. I played a campaign on Australia before. It just was short-lived because a lot of people And like, it was just one of those games that the friends fell off and new. I think a new vampire book dropped and we went back to it, just never came back to the campaign.
Uh-huh, I know what you mean.
That happened. We were young. But the aspect of this is going through the intro. The tragic story of this is that there is a Red Talon who finds his sister's corpse. It's missing her head. It's laid at the totem site for the Rainbow Serpent, which is a Bunyip, is the Bunyip mm-hmm. tribal totem. It's missing the stomach. It was entirely eaten. You know, the innards were eaten, devoured. With the head missing, it was an ultimate insult. And this Red Talon's like the number one. He's the top. He's like the warrior's warrior marching around Australia right now. And he was so enraged that he just looked. He went looking for his sister's head all he could and couldn't find it.
Mm-hmm.
And this mood is called. And when this mood is called, you feel this Red Talon. I felt when I read this, I know for a fact my adrenaline had to be getting up there.
Yeah, me too, my man. Me too. Like, reading through this, when I first started reading it, right, I was like, okay, brass tacks, screw, die all the time, but there's some subtlety there that they don't expand upon, right? Like, this was a guru whose litter mate was also a guru. A guru being born are already a rarity. For like two guru to come out of a litter, that is a bond that is unique amongst the guru nation, something that can never be understated. So him coming up and finding his sister dead at the side of, like, I think it was the Three Sisters Mountains, like a beautiful vista, right? Something that should bring all guru close to Gaia to see her and that site defiled. That
right.
I could feel his rage building, like, in me too.
And when that rage built, there was you wanted to read more of the story. Mm-hmm. I felt that's what kept me reading the story. It's an artist. I think it's an author's trick that should be utilized more. Maybe it has in books. I just didn't catch it. But here I felt it. That's the important part. You know, your passions were engaged. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it helps. We like Red Talon. I know you and I both do. But to read it, and this Red Talon had no choice. He was going to see this as black and white. It's left in the Raybone Serpent. We're going to talk about these Bunyip die. Now, they also get into the fact that the Bunyip haven't been contacted. The Bunyip haven't come out to talk to the guru that are here. In fact, the guru that are here at this moot, and you get this from the story, they're aliens. They came here. This is not their land. They came here and are making themselves the judges of the land. They're making themselves those who are guarding certain sites and keeping the worm at bay. They decided that's what they are. But they're not the Bunyip. And the Bunyip are the ones who were born here.
Mm-hmm.
They were the one whose land this is. And so they hammer that home. Well, now with his dead sister, the head missing and the way she was, he demands them all to die. And there's a rye of the Fianna who's the leader in charge, except Alpha at this point. And she just got it. And I felt for her as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because she did all she could to come up through the ranks, to win the right to be here, to rule, it does so. And she has to look at this, and she sees that he's in the right. He's an Anrun more in the right than anyone, because the Bunyip would have had to have sent just one Bunyip, a kinfolk she could take, to say, hey, you gotta wait till we find out who did it.
Mm-hmm.
We can't just do it. Anyone who's anyone can see this is staged. And she knew that, except she couldn't say that, because she had no leg to stand on
mm-hmm.
amidst all this, right? And, you know, in typical fashion, in great fashion, there are those who oppose it that come up first. And they say all the rational things that we just talked about, right?
Right.
And once they get it out, you then see those who come up and say, that's bullshit. We don't talk about this. They defaced it. They came up. They're trying to challenge us. This is it. These Bunyip had all time in the world to come up here and join us in this new protectorate on this council to say their piece, to have it. They chose not to. This is their land. They would get huge chunks to guard. We would help them whatever they want to do. Where are they at? It's got to be. They fell to the worm, and this is them announcing it. You dare sit there, except Alpha, to tell us to hold on?
Mm-hmm. And that sets that tone for the rest of that meeting, right? Because that's what it is. Because
yep.
who's the ones that are baying for blood besides the Red Talons? You also got the Geta, Fenris, and the Shadow Lords. Number one, remind me if I'm wrong, I thought the Geta and the Shadow Lords hated each other. So to see them, like, united on one topic, that's gonna give everyone, like, a...
I think hate is a word, not to... I can't correct it, because nobody likes the Shadow Lords.
That's true.
Right? So it's like nobody does. The Shadow Lords are the pieces of shit that show up when things go bad and you know it's going to get worse because they're hanging out. And they never have done enough to stick out at villains, but you know they're a villain if they're somewhere, right? That's the feel they give. That's sort of how that tribe is written, even if it's not true. The Gedefenris are written as that force that's going to be the overwhelming brutality no matter what, but that's not necessarily true either. But both tribes make great villains, and in this story, they don't pull punches.
No, they really
about,
don't.
About how they are when they step in. So what you have here is a powder keg. And so the Fianna does what the only thing she can think to do, which is we'll give them 3 days. And if in 3 days we don't, you know, 3 days to prepare. And if they don't come forward to say anything and they don't bring anything or nothing like that, then, you know, I don't even think she says that. In 3 days we hunt is what she says. And why she said that is because she had hoped in 3 days something would be found to save the Bunyip. Word would get to them. They'd help them out, whatever. Now, in this story, they do one thing very well. You know something's up. You know something's up from the way I told it. Right? The way we even mentioned, you know there's a the bottom's dropped out. Wow, this seems really bad. It is bad. It is bad. Now, we're going to tell you now because we're going to skip it in the history later just so you get it fresh in your head. It does go bad for the Bunyip. These Red Talons do not mess around. When everybody assembles to get here to go kill them, they don't just kill them. They freaking annihilate them. We're talking, it's genocide for the Bunyip. It's find them and eradicate them on a horrific level. And this guy was so angered that when the first Bunyip was found, he didn't question why she was wounded. Right? And then someone called, I believe it was Teeth of Blood, was the name of the Red Talon from his own tribe, who saw her first, jumped and killed her quickly, and then came back, said, ah, boss, I killed her. So the Red Talon boss ripped him apart. Because the Guru Law, the greatest of the first kill of the greatest of station, you know, that junk goes to him. I didn't exactly know how that worked out because it didn't make sense to me because the justification was already twisted, right? That typically is left for like hunting for food, right? That sort of thing, or like whatever you find or whatever rewards or battle, you know, glory. I could see it, but this wasn't glory. She didn't offer a challenge. She was wounded. But right there, I was like, man, what are you expecting rationale now? Suddenly off of a war pack primed to go in 3 days. And this guy didn't eat. He didn't do anything but let rage sustain him waiting to do this kill. So when that happens, they go through basically a year of just slaughter.
Yeah.
Hunting down Bunyip and killing him, right? It culminates. Culminates to a point where this Red Talon, this whole war party sitting outside this cave where the last Bunyip is held. And he goes and enters the cave silently and sees the Bunyip. And he's in Kronos. Who knows how many he's killed? He's not going to be impressed or shocked by what this Bunyip can do. And so he already knows it. The Bunyip already knows he's dead. But even in Kronos, the Bunyip turns to him and just basically says, go ahead and kill me. You killed everyone I knew or loved. You killed our way of life. You didn't listen to us. We tried telling you that we didn't kill your sister. We tried telling you we were delayed at getting to your war moot to defend ourselves. We couldn't get there. We were being attacked. There was not what could we do? And but you still don't want to listen, and you're not going to hear it now, so I don't care. Have your vengeance. It's not right. And the Red Talon only sees red. He did the whole time and just kills him. However, what happens when that happens?
When he kills the last Bunyip, which that's what this is, right? It describes that he feels the spirit of the Bunyip passing through him, and in that moment, he can tell that there was no taint of the worm upon them. Right, there's that realization that wait, this isn't right, and it's from there that he starts hearing like this. I think it was like described as cackling, and the black spiral. A black spiral reveals herself, Mara the Screamer. I think we hear more about her later as well.
Just Mara the Scream. I think Screamer implies something different, but Mara the Scream is her name. I want to get it down.
Yeah, you're right.
This one. Get her implications correct. But when Mara the Scream shows up, I even like the way it did. It was as if it was inside his head, right?
Yeah.
He believes there's this dark cavern where she's at, and she comes walking up out of nowhere. She has this leather bag, or not even a leather bag. It was like some like netted bag, I think, in description. To me, it was an old netted bag with something in it, roughly the size of a bowling ball. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Right? And it's the way she said it. You know, she was like, it was us who killed your sister, by the way.
Yeah,
and we enjoyed her sweet screams. It was us who took her head. just so you know, which, by the way, your sister left you a gift, tosses her head towards him.
Mm-hmm. The rotting, so festering head.
And you're thinking to yourself, I would have tore her apart. I'd have tore through her. I would have done that. A lot of people forget, as much rage as werewolves have, there's another crippling emotional half to rage. It's Hirano.
Mm-hmm.
It's a guilt so pervasive, so overwhelming that it cripples you. Right? It stops you from being able to do anything, really. And that's what more or less the author describes without saying it. That the moment he knew, he just systematically killed a tribe of Gaia. Right? You know, which is supposed to be their brothers and sisters. And to the Red Talon, the Bunyip are close.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he felt that. He felt that purity of how they matched up. Because the Bunyip live in harmony with nature, and that's wild. Oh, man. He had messed up. Well, he does decide that he wants to kill this woman. However, she faded into the shadows in the darkness of the cavern. Right? When the tribe runs in, it's because they hear his shout of grief. Of such, you know, just broken grief that they think something's up. And that war council comes like, oh, what did you see? What's going on? And he tells them, you know, I was wrong. It wasn't the Bunyip. They're forgiven. And I can never be forgiven, basically. And he dives in the darkness to go kill what was there, which we know was Black Spirals, never to be seen again. And what creeped me out, and what I like about the author is more or less, that group searched that cave looking for him.
Can never find him. Can never
right,
find him again.
They dove in looking where and how. And they don't need to finish that story. You don't need the rest of that tale to be told. Right? To kind of get that that's... the worm is the villain, and that's how it goes down. And you know, you played yourself is sort of the name of the story. And what an opening.
Yeah.
What an opening to a good book, right? It's like, oh, okay, we're going to get into that type of stuff. Okay, cool. So that story has a lot of elements. A couple themes here. It's alienation.
Mm-hmm.
It's being on a continent of Australia. And let's admit, folks, we've heard all sorts of kinds of stories about Australia, right? This land is so beautiful. Come and see it. Vacation here. It's amazing. It's glorious. And then you watch, like, Mad Max. The open, you know, waste of a desert. And where the hell is that at? That seems uninhabitable. Uh-huh. Who could live there? All that sort of craziness, right? You know that there's like over 200 species of things that could kill you with tiny bites.
Mm-hmm. Spiders. Spiders everywhere. That's what I think of when I hear of Australia.
It's tough, right? You hear about all this stuff, you're like, whoa, right? Some heavy things. And this book is very good at capturing that feeling and forcing you to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They want you to have that when you explore this book in the regions and kind of highlight it. They even go through the due diligence of listing every film possible that Mel Gibson's in. It cracks me up. Right? The filmography, Mel Gibson. You want to know what's in this book? Mel Gibson. You want to check out what Australia's like? Good. Mel Gibson did too. He did this film here, Mel Gibson. And, oh, okay. I wonder what tribe Mel Gibson is, you know, just out of humor. But I feel the authors were in that niche. Like, of all the films, Mel Gibson's in a lot of them. You could just go watch it in that day and age.
Mm-hmm.
I'm certain there are more Australian films now. Books aplenty. But why I want to highlight that alienation is because if you're thinking you're going to read this book and learn all about the Bunyip and the ins and outs and like it's a tribe book for the Bunyip, no, they're dead.
Mm-hmm. So it's spoiler alert, folks. That's it's what the first story is about. The rest of the book is about like immense guilt, because at the end of that tale, like they don't still believe the Bunyip were bad or worm or like worm tainted. Like there's no illusion there. Those tribes that are in Australia know they messed up bad, and they gotta carry that weight for the rest of, well, until the apocalypse.
Right. And instead of this book being the title of, you know, their tagline, When Will You Rage, it's When Will You Cry.
Mm-hmm.
That's how sad this is. It's like when you read about all these spirits that are in the dream time, which is what they refer to as the Umbra here, the penumbra here. Really cool place. 50,000 years of history here.
Right.
That the Bunyip have cultivated and protected. Nowhere else are you going to find a history so in-depth. Yet there's no one to tell the stories.
Not anymore. Like, that's one of the things they hammer home when they're describing the dream time, as they call it that, right? It's because in, like, the, well, in the Bunyip culture, and they sing their histories, right, constantly. That's a huge part of their religion and their culture. And now that that's, like, now that the Bunyip are gone, those Bunyip that set the wards to protect it, to make it what it is, that's slowly eroding away. Because these Guru don't understand that. That's not how they relate to the Umbra.
And why don't they understand it? Well, let me tell you a tale or two. right? We'll both go mm-hmm. through it. We'll make it real simple. I'm not proud of this history because it hits home a little too hard. In other words, it triggered me mm-hmm. quite a bit to go through this. And it talks about the fact that beyond the opening story, it's like it's 50,000-year-old Aborigines.
Mm-hmm.
They're indigenous to Australia. This is their land. Like, I've been here for 50,000 years. There's nowhere else I've ever heard of people being that long, right? In that regard. Like, that's, or at least let's put it this way. I don't memorize it. Once we get beyond like 5,000 years, my brain's like, cool, whatever.
Yeah, you can't visualize that, right?
That's where it goes. Love history as much as I want to. I didn't want to read about vampire politics in Neolithic periods, right? I'm all good. I'm all good. Might makes right. You pick up a stone, smash prince in torpor, me eat now. Like, whatever, you know, Protean is typical. I don't need to hear all that. Mm-hmm. And so when I think of 50,000-year-old Aborigines being somewhere and it's legit, it's literally like, wow. Well, there's no contest whose continent that is, right? It gets worse. You know, where I won't say worse. They go on to talk about that the Aborigines are immune to the delirium due to them living off the land and understanding a balance with Gaia. Therefore, the impergium never happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll repeat that. They knew nature and were born to it, and time didn't. Australia is not attached to anything.
No.
You know, at that point or now, you know, there's no walking over to it naturally at this point, because all the animals that would have been going over it already happened. They talk about a great earthquake that separated the two in Australia and all that, but that's so long ago, man wouldn't have thought. And point is, all the animals that were coming are there. And then they're separated. So virtually they're living undiscovered by anything Weaver-esque.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just them going about their life. And what the Aborigines decide in their culture, the fact that everyone lives in harmony, that every animal and every being has the same spiritual worth. How awesome is that? You know, everything has a place. And because of that, they know the hierarchy of self. They're more intelligent than these animals,
mm-hmm.
But they're still of the same spiritual worth. And so they help the animals fulfill their purpose, going so far as to dig watering holes for those animals who are waning because the desert is too harsh, you know, for that moment. They go, you know, they'll raise certain crops so they could offset their eating of certain things. They even have gender assignment for what to do, but not because it's sexist. They don't believe in a sexist boundary. It's just the men go and hunt to get meat, the women get the vegetables, because apparently women could cook some mean vegetables, and guys only know, ugh, they're kill. Bring back and cook. And technically, men and women can barbecue equally. I just see more men sweating around that BBQ with pride than I have women, you know?
Yeah.
And I would never trust my dad to make a salad, okay? I'm just saying. Mom made bomb ass salads. It's just been my experience. Now,
Dad, we asked you to make a salad. Why is there brisket on my plate?
Right. It's just because brisket's a salad, right? You would sit there chewing it, stare me in the eye, right? Say something. Your mom ain't here to save you, but whatever, right? Move on. But I'm just saying, they don't make a distinction. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal. It's just how they worked. And that's that. And they give the impression that they were in harmony. You know, you just had your assignments, you did what you did, everybody came back and had fun. You were talking about their cultural, artistic ability and how they told their history. They were poets, they were sculptors, they were, what's that other one, painters,
mm-hmm.
And singers, and that's how they told all their history and culture and shared it. They did it collectively, though. This means that whether you could paint, sculpt, or what have you, I'd start telling my tale and I'd sing it. Pause, you would draw a picture of the next part of the story. Pause, and Brent Tron finishes the sculpture of it, and that ends the story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tale. And the next time we come around, and the kids come around, we would tell our story again. And it wouldn't matter who it is, and we'd get better each time we told it. Others would try and add to it, and details would be added, more sculpture, more painting, more whatever. Or however that worked out, that's the impression I got. The community had a hand in telling the tale. It wasn't any one person's ego. And in this, everyone knew the history.
Mm-hmm.
That's what made them great. Not just them. Because you've got to remember, the Bunyip are still not being talked about here. Just the Aborigines.
Right.
These are the kinfolk of the Bunyip. The Bunyip were true spiritual shape changers that sat amongst them as mystics. They were an entity that the Aborigines didn't even consider part of themselves. They were spirits of the dream time as far as they were considered, the Bunyip.
Mm-hmm.
And that's written very clearly. And so the Bunyip had to do very little to the Aborigines because they lived in such harmony, they didn't have to worry about an imbalance. What the Bunyip are doing as they were making deals with the spirits of the land to ward off and keep hidden, ward others off from coming to Australia and keep Australia hidden from everything else that was going on. And so, too, they had, like, they talk about someone came from China and actually discovered it,
mm-hmm.
and the Bunyip set brush fires and gnat flies and worse, you know, six some annoyances on them, so it sucked to be there, and led them to a vast open desert, and China was like, there is nothing here for us. It took off, right? So, like, screw this. It left, right? Which is all good. I think Spain came here, got some love, too. They were like, new El Dorado? No. How about some, you know, crotch pot cooking, chafing armor, and oh, look, another day with no water whatsoever unless we boil it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm out. We're good. We're all good. We're leaving. And so apparently England didn't even bother at this point to send anybody because they heard rumors of it. We're like, so far, so good. As all things go, the technocracy. That's right. Mages ruined this story of bliss.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. Old technocracy. We can't let any good mysteries exist in the world. We got to ruin everyone's fun. That's what I got from that.
That's correct. That's correct. This is the jump the shark moment for Bob. This is the equivalent of me wondering. I was wondering where the Mexico by night was going to come for Werewolf, and this is that book for me. Right? Where it jumps in. I don't mean the standalone book where it talks about the Sabbat. I'm talking about where they're hunting the wild, crazy Methuselah and Samuel Hayes in it. That's what I felt this was. Right when I saw that. So let me get this straight. There's a technocracy technocratin around because it's a werewolf book. Why the hell is this mage in it? And these mages are going around doing what? Oh, they're trying to eliminate enigmas from the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so in the course of them eliminating enigmas, they come across Australia and they're like, ooh, those are Bunyip wards. So we're going to go there and eliminate the Bunyip wards and now we can see Australia. Now the world can participate with you. You're welcome. I'm thinking to myself, if I am a Bunyip, strangely, I'm drawn to that Neolithic area where I'm hoping they just go to the Dreamtime and grab that caveman attitude, grab a rock, walk over, and crush the mage's head.
Right? Or better yet, one of those giant, what do they call them? They're like a boomerang, but they're the ones built for war. The ones 4 feet long.
The Piggy Billithrilla.
Yes, the Piggy Billithrillas. Those things. How could they be stopped?
Right. How could they be stopped? And because I don't know the name of it, but that's the name of it now. And <that's>, I want to highlight that Piggy Bill is awesome. But anyway, regardless, I guess they had to have a point where things don't go so well.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't even talk about the worm. And that annoys me about mages in this point in the day of the world of darkness here, is that they always serve that MacGuffin. They're like that piece of crap that comes along that just, like, for no reason, we dabbled, bad things happened, and we left.
Right. Like, they're always that, for any It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia fans, they're the wild cards, right? Like, the guru are just traveling in their van, then they try to stop, but they can't because the mages cut their brake lines. Why? Because they're mages. They're curious. They want to see what's going to happen, and they just bail out the back. That's my read.
Right. Well, because I was sitting there thinking to myself, I was like, the great conquest going on. I think England kind of had the trump card in exploring and finding new places and getting it done.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys had the mentality of, there's not enough England for us all to be part of the House of Lords. My family's about to lose their aristocracy title if we don't find a place to grow some wealth in. Because I certainly can't get the land my brother has. He's a little too young to be dying of a cold. Right? So I need to leave to find my wealth. This place seems barren. Maybe we can make something of it. And that would have been enough of a reason, like, but we had to add technocracy. It just annoyed me.
Mm-hmm.
My fee-fees were hurt. Everyone else, I drink my water with my pinky up. That's my problem. So, moving on, we have that little snafu done, and it dawned on me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Clearly in my notes is where the stock came up. I said, hang on a second. The Bunyip only mated with the Thylacine.
Mm-hmm.
Right, Thylacine was like basically the Tasmanian devil, the wolves that hunted solitarily. They were not really wolves; they're marsupials.
Right, so they're not related to wolves. They're not related to dogs. They're something completely different, more akin to kangaroos, right.
More akin to a 50,000-year-old history of untouched by man.
Yeah, that too.
Right, you know, living in heart. Right, that's uh-huh. What we have going on. And I'm sort of like, okay, so they started mating with that, and they mated out of their wolf kin.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're not werewolves anymore. Right. And I was like, they're not like by that distinction, your origins were werewolves. When you breed out of it, the werewolf, the wolf part's extinct. Your Bunyip, that's got to be some tie in. Maybe they explain that. They don't, folks. I'm letting you know. I went into the weeds with it a little bit because I was like, that's actually fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because that means the shape changing element, you could choose to a different animal create something completely new. It could still carry the shape-changing gene. They proved that could happen here. And then I said to myself, this would have been included in another book if that were possible, Bob. Note that this is the only book they talk about this happening in.
Right. So, like, right? this raised, like, a lot of questions for me, too, right? So, like, you know, they made it with the marsupials there. You go back in the family line long enough, there are wolves for the bunyip, not for the thylacines. But, right. like, they, to like, segue just a little bit, they talk about dingoes, right? Dingoes were introduced to Australia, like, 3,000 years ago, and they started driving the thylacines to extinction because they were faster or they were stronger, right?
And pack hunters, yep.
Right, and pack hunters, right? So, you know, Australia, like we've already kind of hinted at, maybe not said it straight out, there's no wolves in Australia. So what do all the guru, like, lupus mate with, or what do the lupus come from? They come from dingoes. And that made me start questioning, like, wait a minute. Okay, they're in, like, the canine family, right? But dingoes aren't wolves. They're like dingoes. They're close to it, right? They're side by side with wolves and dogs. So you guys,
but they're closer than the thylacine.
Yeah, absolutely, because they're still in the same, like, lupus family, right? Genus. I'm not a biologist. I don't remember the family, right? But they're all related.
But you internet looked it up like I did, and you were just like,
But then I started thinking, okay, so, like, why did the guru never mate with coyotes in, like, North America? Right? That's where I went. I was like, all right, so there's a North American basically equivalent of a dingo. Biologists, y'all can correct me if we have any biologist fans, that I equate coyotes in North America with dingoes. So why? There are no red wolves in Tennessee anymore. But you know what we have plenty of? Coyotes. They're, like, everywhere.
99 Dalmatians. You can bring back the guru. 99 Dalmatians, right? That's a lot of dogs.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of pure breed. But the point is, they're not thylacine. That must be, there's something magical about thylacine. You know, but regardless, I saw that and I was like, okay, that's interesting. Maybe someone knows the answer to that, but I combed this book pretty thorough, looked for it, didn't see it. Other than that's just unique. Mm-hmm. It was just, to me, they put it in there to sing the fact that it's a rare breed that was there in Australia and only existed in one place. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. Thylacine are now extinct.
Right.
As well. As are the bunyip. So there you go. The other factor here was that the Aborigines were immune to delirium for their harmony in nature. And I actually got pissed when I thought of that initially. And you might be thinking, Bob, you're a real volatile guy. No, it's not mad like, you know, you guys suck. It's because I sat there and went, why do the Native Americans are not seen as to live in harmony with nature?
Right. Why don't the Native Americans get the pass for delirium? Is it because the Utena and the Croat and the Wendigo, like, they partook of the Impergium, right?
And so that's the number one reason that I came up with when I wrote that down. I'm glad you caught that. And for the record, I'm going to tell you, Brentron, I sat there and went, that makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. I didn't fucking think of it till you said it right now. I'm going to fully admit it to you. I'll give that to you. That's high five. That's a great catch. That's where the fear is, mm-hmm. right? The Impergium leads to the delirium and has that going on. All right. So now that I'm curbed accordingly, and I appreciate that, and that explains why the bunyip are cool. And now, right as rain with it.
Okay.
So that's why we have discussions. Mm-hmm. Awkward pack peddling. All right. Moving on. Because I got my eye blackened for lack of forethought in that, let me turn around, and it's rare that happens, but I love it when it happens. Let's talk about the Howling Three, the marsupials. I know what you're thinking. That came out of left field. Have you seen, my fellow horror brother, have you seen the Howling series?
The Howling series. So wait, was that British movie about the train conductor being attacked by werewolves, was that called The Howling? Was that in that series?
No, that's a good movie, but that's recent. I forget how young you are.
Okay.
How blessed it must be. So The Howling is the first werewolf film that came out that scared a lot of people when they saw it, because the special effects were on par with American Werewolf in London.
Mm-hmm.
If you saw that first one, right? They're up there the same thing.
That one I've seen.
It's because that's a super classic. But The Howling's that off-niche thing they tried to do. But The Howling I believe that was Cinemax tainted. Like, there's a lot of sexuality in The Howling typically. Mm. But you overlooked it because usually a group of people got devoured at the end of it. Or something weird happened, right? In that vein. The Howling one at least was the best. Typically it's how it works. However, they had multiple movies for The Howling, and one of them was The Howling 3, The Marsupials. So bad, the authors earned points for me 100% when they were like, don't watch this film, but technically you can look at some Australia stuff in it. And that's that. And they had to say it that way. And they had to say it when this book came out. It was in the era of that movie. And they had to do it because it's like, you're going to come across it. We're sorry. You know, we didn't make the film. Now, why I put it that way is because I believe there's footage of the thylacine that is in that marsupial Howling 3,
mm-hmm.
which is another reason they're like, we didn't do that because of that. But, you know, there's no relation. They point that out. So if anybody else is going, the Howling 3 inspired him, no, it didn't. They're very much saying no. But you could look at it if you want to, you know, no big deal. It's a movie that we can all share in the terror that exists. But I digress. So Australia gets discoverable, mm-hmm. right? We'll just leave it at that. When it becomes discoverable, Jump the Shark 2 occurs for me. Because apparently, if you're a werewolf group and you were hidden from everything for a long time, a ship comes along with diseased white people that have cargo of slaves that are coming to you.
Mm-hmm.
And in that cargo, there's a mixed bag of whatever, right? And we'll get to that in a second. But the most important thing, the vampires are with them.
Yeah.
Vampires and Fomori are with this boat. This diseased boat. The same diseased boat happened to who? It happened to the Pure Lands, right? Everything was peachy, hunky-dory, and then the diseased group got here and things got a whack. We see the same thing.
Oh, don't forget the Bane. Don't forget the Bane that's on the fleet with, like, the three half-tribes of werewolves moving to Australia and the vampires and the mages. Do they have a mummy in the cargo space? I didn't see that on the manifest.
Actually, yes.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Actually, yes. Mummy in this book. Yes. So, but before we I mean, as comical as that is, it's very funny to see it, but it's so true. That's coming in. I want to tell you that all those folks have a huge impact in the modern when you play the setting.
Mm-hmm.
They're just building history, right? And what they tell you is that a large amount, something very terrible happened in the, I believe, 18th century is what it is, and that's indentured servitude was brought to the fore.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is that I believe it was the Brits who decided that America was going to receive all their criminals. They're going to take them in.
Yeah. Georgia was started as a penal colony, right? And I don't think it was like violent convicts, but it was people that basically owed money, right? So not like the indentured servitude, like I signed this contract, I'll be free. It's like, judge, you're sentenced to work 10 years in Georgia.
Right. And they had people there who in Europe, like there was one woman who said she's descendant of someone who stole a silk kerchief
mm-hmm.
off a cart. And I think they were a kid at the time. And they got sentenced to leave the continent.
Mm-hmm.
Goodbye, thief. They were getting rid of everybody. Well, after the War of Independence in 1776, America was like, F you, don't send us crap that we don't want. And it's that simple. And they were like, all right, well, what's Australia doing?
A whole bunch
that's
of nothing.
Essentially... Yeah, that's essentially what happened. And they said, we're going to send them all over there. Well, oddly, the Irish get brought into the mix as well. And they don't really define in the book as to how or why, just that the Fianna had kinfolk in there and they went to protect their kinfolk.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess is the same thing all this time. Not enough space and a lot, too much people, not enough space in a land of potentiality. Why? Because stories of discovering a new land mean that there's new land to be had, stuff to work it. And if you don't have the money to be, you know, well, to be an aristocrat coming on your own, all right, I got to be in this penal group, so be it. And that's more or less what happened. And they come over, they work the lands, that's what they're doing. But I told you it was bad because indentured servitude sucks. Mm-hmm. We all know that, right? But I don't want you to get the impression that we just came over and they stopped whining, they built some ports, everything worked out, and everybody was happy. Of course they weren't. Because the Silver Fangs were the officers that came over on this boat of evil, and the Bonars were the...
the masses.
They're not pirates, but they're not the pirates, but what do they call them? If I'm not a pirate, when am I on a boat?
See,
crew, sorry.
They were
the crewmen.
Right.
They're the crew that came with. And so when they come over, the first thing I understand is that for some reason, there's this dichotomy where the Silverfangs and Bonars tend to end up working in tandem to horrible effect. Right? And that's what this was. And the Fianna are victimized in the middle here. And that's what baffled the crap out of me. It wasn't bad enough the Bunyip are wiped out, right? It's that as the Fianna get here and there's kind of hope and opportunity, and let's protect our kin, you got Silverfangs going, there are an awful lot of black people here.
And the Bonars are just side-eyed. I'm like, wait, what'd you say?
Right. Not just any bonar. You had the saucy femme fatale pork chop.
Pork chop. Holy crap.
Side eye that Silverfang, right? Side eye good old Silverfang, who had the cheesiest name I can't remember. Let me hunt this down real quick. Let's see. I know I wrote his name. There's pork chop.
The Silverfang?
Earl Blaze.
Yeah.
Earl Blaze of Uffington with family in the House of Lords. I was Uffington.
Mm-hmm. And
Lord Blaze.
Since we're talking about his name, I got to throw this out. There's like a one sentence reference to like his second in command, right? They call him his Seneschal. His deed name is the most demeaning deed name I have ever heard. As my Lord commands, are you kidding me? That has got to be a deed name the Bonars gave him.
No, that's the name the Bonars told him, please keep it. Right? Publicly, the Bonars are like, poor Chop looked at him, oh, as the Lord wants, oh, such a great, you noble lad. You certainly know how to serve well. Keep at it. Keep at it. Bless his heart. Right? Mm-hmm. And he said there, and he goes, of course, it's good to serve. You know, and who was going to correct it, right? Everybody thought it was funny, and it's got to be the laughing stock, right? It's such an embarrassing name. I agree with that. The other half of this is, though, with these two standard names, what is my problem with Blaze? It's this. Blaze comes over with the idea of being the king of Australia.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he wants more than anything, and he assumed, since the Silverfangs are the lords, the kings of the Guru, that when he gets here, naturally, they're going to supplant whoever is here. Whatever where was to show up because he's the kings of them. And this island is now his. This continent's now his. And that's that. And Porkchop goes, no, sweetie. I went to a moot with a bunch of black people. And they don't like being called black people, but you're going to call them black people. They're Aborigines. They actually have been here for over 50,000 years. And they're kind of watching the place, you know. And they said they got these spiritual guys called Bunyips. I checked. They're werewolves.
Mm-hmm.
No. You're not the guy in charge. That's, sucks to be you. Better luck next time. But we maybe can get a sept going and blah, blah, blah. And she, like, fades away into the distance, right? Like, Betty Boops him. Shows up to boop, boop, be-doop, and walks off. And then, you know, he's sitting back, Lord Blaze. He rolls a fatty, takes a big puff, leans back, and he tries to figure out ways to dominate. Like, you know, the New Jack City of the werewolf continents here. And that's how I see it, because this guy said some of the most hateful crap that I ever read in a book, right?
Yes.
Earl Blaze felt bigotry suited him, right? And I quote, the Aboriginals, whom in his eyes were primitive blacks. That's simple. Why is that hateful? That's as close that I've read in a White Wolf book of them using straight-up hatred.
Mm-hmm.
Racial hatred, right? So close to the... We're not even close to the mark. That's on the mark, in my opinion. And that's what it is. Add to the fact that the Bunyip were irrelevant to the superiority of the European Guru. Right? That's just by default. F them. We don't know who they are. We're on their continent. I was like, okay, so it's the Native American takeover all over again.
Mm-hmm.
Except we're doing it over here, and it's done by the Brits. Okay. Well, the colonists were the Brits, right? So if you're me in America, I go, it's still the Brits. Right? This lately to your time dilation. It's still the Brits. They're just the Brits who broke away from the crown. That's what the colonists are. So, kumse. But as a self-respecting black man, I sat here wishing something hateful was going to happen. That, like, the worst thing was going
to
happen.
Oh, it did. It did. Something very hateful happened to that man.
Uh-huh. And I love spoilers in that regard, because F this character.
Right.
Right? You're not disappointed, because the Fianna are good at one thing, and that's, if we don't like you, we can make it last.
Uh-huh.
That's the best thing. But let's talk about the atrocities. From this dude's hatred, they end up doing some of the worst crap ever done, right? They get through phases here with the Aborigines where they decide that they're getting rid of them. They're going to force them to move,
mm-hmm.
which is basically a clever way of saying genocide, right? They're going to kill and cull them to force them to go more to the center of Australia so that the shipping continues to their ports, and we get that riffraff away from everyone else. I that nonsense, you know, I understand history, whatever. White Wolf didn't do it. But the point is, the authors didn't do it. But when you read that stuff and you didn't know, and I wasn't prepared for it again, mm-hmm. I read this with immature eyes when I was young back in the day. To see it now, where you're researching and looking it up, it put stopping points in it because I couldn't stomach it. I couldn't deal. I felt the depth of rage. I couldn't imagine. The quotes in here, coming from Aboriginal writings and authors who were talking about the times in that era, and poetry it came from, is like slam hatred poetry, or just, you know, just someone getting something out. And it's so powerful, it doesn't help you stay in the pocket of reading, and I applaud the authors for that. But again, folks, still, we're not talking about the Bunyip. Right, we still just got this. These European guru coming over. We got one guy to focus that hate on, and we know he's cleverly being used to talk about the horrible stuff that was done at the times. Right, but that mix gives you that. Oh, at least it did for me. I'm gonna tear the walls down almost. And when you read about it, the Fianna are there, and they're like, "We didn't forget about any of this."
Mm-hmm.
Right, we're amongst it. And you got to remember, they said the people here were criminals. And the Bonars and the Fianna were working with the folks who got here, and we're trying to show them that this is a second chance. However you got here, this is the lot you've been dealt with, and we're going to help. We're going to help each other get through it. And they start building a community down here, and that includes the Aborigines.
Mm-hmm.
And they start talking with them to let them know we don't think like these idiots. We don't agree with them. They see us as less too, and all this nonsense. And they start, bless the Fianna. You know, they just decide, you know what, if you're a tyrant, I'm in your face.
Yeah, they point out that there was a very, like, outspoken child of Gaia that said, hey, you should stop this. This is wrong. This is dumb. And he got exiled to, like, the prison of the prison colony island, right? But whereas the child of Gaia was speaking out, it was the Fianna that were the ones taking action in the end. And that's what I liked about the Fianna in this. Like, it goes at length talking, like you said, they were working with the masses, with the people there. The Bonar specifically started, like, organizing and connecting a lot of the convicts, right? The people that were actually exiled to that colony, willing to work with them and try to, you know, make life better for them.
It had to happen. Had to happen. Because when you see that go on, you're wondering about, well, if the leadership's corrupt, wouldn't they do something about it? And that's where you got to understand the political climate. When the Silver Fiends got here, they came as officers backed by the House of Lords, which means the British Empire.
Mm-hmm.
There is nobody for them to turn to. Despite what you may think, you can have a tribal world stand up and try to say, no, humans, we're going to crush you. If you haven't been paying attention, they just bring an army to wipe out that guru tribe.
Yeah, it's true.
That's what humans do. Right, delirium be damned. If you could cause delirium, but you could be a bear to an army, and the larger the army, the lesser the threat you are for just that bear, or that even a group of you. And I mean, you bring danger to all werewolves when that happens, so, you know, there's laws to follow. There's still a litany. They can't just do that and put everyone at risk, even if they would win. Because at what cost? And then what are you at that point? And who wins but the worm, right? So, good guy S, they're kind of hands tied, trapped. But they're using rights and policies of an abominable nature to kind of get this done. Now, I want to tell you that this something magical happens. This backs up and everything's good and they don't do this anymore or whatever. Now, more or less, the Fianna war with the Silver Fangs on throughout.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a constant. The Fianna can't get a clear win because, let's face it, they're doing illegal things according to the lawmakers, which are the Silver Fangs. And it's rinse and repeat. And they're going at it like cats and dogs. There's just no way to make that easy. So much so that there is a Fianna who says, you know what, we're done with this. And they get enough of their own kin together and said, this tyrant goes down now. And they go at this Silver Fang, right? Good old Blaze.
Mm-hmm.
When they go at Blaze, he has protectors. Those protectors have silver claws and tear everybody apart. But not before the head of the Fianna grabbed one arm and her buddy grabs the other arm and tear him in half.
Yeah, straight wishbone him, right? Satisfying. I have to say, that is, I think her name, yeah, I got it here. Bridget with flashes in her eyes, and her brother, Dougal, were the ones that...
so good.
Mm-hmm.
So good. A beer. Cheers to them, is what I say. That's such a good ending to that asshole. And who stands up after him, though, isn't so bad. I'll state that.
Mm-hmm.
Gray Mane of the Silver Fangs, who stands in, smartly says, hey, you know, six Fianna died, so, you know, that answers for one Silver Fang being killed. That's fair. Let's call it even, everybody. And the Silver Fangs are like, really? And he's like, yeah, really. He looks at the Fianna. The Fianna are like, well, you know, fair play. Everyone's happy. Everyone's happy. We're all good. And then he's like, but don't forget, we killed the Bunyip. Don't everybody be happy at once, right? That's what I feel happened, right? He's like, don't forget, we killed the Bunyip. Huh? Huh? And you sit back. Why? what's going on here in Australia is that with the bunyip dead, they're the protectors of the whole freaking continent, and they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of them coming over to make peace with the tribe who knew what was going on, and to go after the very most powerful spiritual sites built up and cleverly brought up over time, they come to a place that's an alien world. They might as well have flown to Mars and decided to colonize it and see what happens. And I know that's a bit of an exaggeration, but not spiritually. Definitely not spiritually. There's an enemy everybody forgets about.
Is it the worm? Is it the worm?
Yeah.
Ah, yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely, it's the worm, right? So we let these vampires come in, and what do you think happened to them? Yeah, nothing.
Yeah, they were just there. That's what it's been. Like, yeah, there are vampires here. Well, what do they do? Not a lot.
I mean, they tell you what they do. They do vampire stuff, right? Even the Sabbats over here.
Uh-huh.
The Sabbat get involved in organized crime and war with each other. There's, like, freaking drug problems here, right? There's cocaine. There's a werewolf, and I believe it's a, was it a Red Talon?
Rage in the streets. Yeah.
Yes, there's a Red Talon that gets in the mix with some Sabbat over cocaine deals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And turns out the Sabbat turn around, he becomes a dealer. He's a supplier of it, like going back and forth. He's a Red Talon. I was like, oh, how the mighty have fallen.
How the mighty have fallen, sir. He is using their own traps against them. That's what he's doing.
Yeah. Yeah, using their own traps. That's what we all say, right? I don't get high on my own supply for me. I get high on my own supply for you. How do I know if it's pure? How do I know if what I'm selling is grade A? That way you know what the set the price at is fair. Can I get a little more of that, please? Don't worry about it. You're a little too much in that bag. It's not exactly an eighth. You know, come on, right? It reads that way. That dude is not fit for this world, right? Let's talk about the abomination he is to the Red Talons. You're in the city?
Mm-hmm.
Doing what again? Yeah, kill this fool. What is wrong with you? Right? Meanwhile, you're the Sabbat. Can I tell you a story? It's like, well, yeah, it's great. It's great. You know the cocaine supply we get all the way from Mexico somehow out here? It's hell to get it out here, right? Yeah. But we get it. We get it. We get it, right? He's like, yeah, I got one of those werewolves to sell it for us. No, you didn't. No, I'm serious. I'm serious, Bishop. Chill out. Like, I bet you your title. I did. Not that I want your title, because it's Australia, right? Really, what's it going to be worth? But the point is that you're, come on, let's go talk to him. It's great. He'll come meet us for an 8-ball. I promise. You got an 8-ball? Sure. That's how silly I feel it is, right, for that character. But it's really a plot seed. It's one to point out the werewolves that came over here were changed in their grief.
Mm-hmm.
They were completely changed. Remember, the leader of the Red Talons that everyone was so proud of, they have a great shame as a tribe over here that they killed the bunyip. That they didn't get over it. There's no way to get over that. They wiped them out. It's their effort that did it. That Hirano is just a... If you're the worm, this is where you vacation.
Mm-hmm. It feels at times going through this book, this is the place on Earth that the worm has won. That's what I get several times out of this.
Now, I don't get one, and we'll talk about that in a second. I get, oh, man, if he has to study if the psychological effects work, oh, buddy. But that chick who came in, Mara Scream or whatever, that's a Black Sparrow Dancer checkmate. That introduction of this book, why it's the intro of the book, because it explains to you, the reader, why nobody's winning over here in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way you can. How do you make up for the bunyip kill at your claws? And you did it. It's not the War of Rage. You did it anyway. Nothing can make up for it, right? You just got to deal. People are waiting for the bunyip to come walking out of the Dream Tribe or the Dream Time, as if there was a hidden pocket of kinfolk somewhere that'll make up for it. And then, oh, okay, we could be forgiven because they're still around. No, there's no forgiveness coming. Sometimes you do stuff. Sorry doesn't cut it. And you got to reap the whirlwind. And that's what this is about. There are a series of Cairns that are left vulnerable and open and are getting weaker by the year because there's not enough Guru to cover them on a whole continent. Not only that, every spirit in the Dreamtime is opposed to the Guru being there at all. That includes BSDs, by the way. They're just trying to like get rid of them. Make it uncomfortable, make it impossible, untenable. Don't teach them crap. Kill them if you can. The whole nine. Why? The bunyip tended to them for over 50,000 years. The spirits in the end, they earned their loyalty and everything else. And they know the bunyip are too nice, too polite. It wasn't their way to wage war and slaughter folk. Here it is, right? Just to rifle through it, because I know we've been here a while at it. But some things to point out. Cool things the Aborigines do, they're given credit for it, their spiritualism. This book gives them loosely, I might add, all sorts of spiritual power that they could do associated with the Dreamtime. So if you want to pull off a cool shaman, they have a list of powers that the Aborigines could do. And I'm going to help you out with something that tripped me up. In here, it talks about the fact that the coming of Blaze and how he saw the Aborigines and the tactics he was using. I didn't talk about the tactic where Blaze comes in and to get rid of the Aborigines, he kidnaps a bunch of the kinfolk of the Bunyip, mm-hmm. holds them hostage, and tries to get the Bunyip to come out of hiding to come save them so he could talk to them because he demanded them come to his court.
Yeah, and what did they do? What did those... what did those kinfolk do? They willed themselves to die rather than weaken the Bunyip or hurt the Bunyip.
Now, that's an interesting way to put it, right? We're talking suicide, folks.
Mm-hmm.
But they're highlighting the fact that the Aborigines don't see it that way. They believe their spiritual energy, when they die, simply is their spiritual energy now just in the Dreamtime. And that eventually they will come back in another body.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how it is. It comes in cycles. All of it is. And so to them, all right, we're at a bad position. It's untenable. This is what's happened. I bid you adieu. And I'm out. Now, that's cool, actually, in a way, to know that power apparently is an indigenous to all Aborigines, only certain ones or whatever, was to those kinfolk of the Bunyip. But they could do things like psychic abilities, like mm-hmm. the ability to tell communication using smoke signals.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It was a cool thing. But from those smoke signals, if you could see them, you get psychic messages, the ability to talk. Speaking through dreams and actually knowing that those messages are, well, they're messages, not just dreams, you know, interpret it and react accordingly and it be accurate. Healing, dormancy, a bunch of interesting things that they lay towards you that they're not like direct powers, but believe they can do, which made that really cool. Because now you wonder what the Bunyip can do. And the Bunyip had a series of unique gifts that they have in there, and they do list those.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something the Bunyip were doing, and that is they kept the Dreamtime preserved, like Brentron had said earlier at the beginning. But what happens to the Bunyip tribe here is that they become ghosts.
The ghost tribe.
This tripped me up,
mm-hmm.
because it's horrific. In this book, there's several times they mention that some of the problems that they're having at Cairns is that an unknown foe is showing and driving people insane and tearing apart everyone but leaving like one survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know what was going on or what happened. Well, the Bunyip, as they got massacred during that War of Tears, as they refer to it as, they become something else.
Right. They don't return to that cycle that all Guru return to when they pass. Instead, they were getting, well, I consider it getting stuck in near the dark umbra, I think is what they called it.
What they talk about is that process, and they're very specific in there, and I'm trying to remember it here, but I agree that stuck is something they didn't say they were, because you got to remember, in Wraith the Oblivion, and that's what they're referring to, right? Because the Dark Umber is Wraith, mm-hmm. is Oblivion. They're near there, but they're not there. They're still on this plane. They're just at a point where it's like basically you could see the world of the dead, and they could tap dance there, but they're still very much part of the Dreamtime as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is that when a person dies and they become a Wraith, they're trapped in that Shadowlands, and that's where they're at, or the Dark Umber, if you prefer. And that's great. They're there for a purpose. They have their reasons, and they got to go through a series of challenges until they feel they're ready to move on. They've accomplished enough to finally let go, and boom, that's the good way. Or they become consumed by their passions and never find a way to move on and become a part of Oblivion's servants. That which just seeks to end everything. A cessation, because that's Wraith in a different podcast.
Mm-hmm.
However, the Bunyip don't end up like that. Like, they're a ghost of a type. But what I feel happens is they become the wrath of the land more than anything else. That everybody came there and the Bunyip did no wrong. And they didn't offer them open arms because they knew they brought the worm with them, especially because they couldn't see it. And they couldn't come out to talk to them to help them because they knew what they did in the Pure Lands.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, they did the only thing they knew what they could do is remain hidden and stay away. And if at all possible, unless absolutely needed, they wouldn't intervene. And when they could intervene, the Black Sparrow Dancers knew of them, hunted them, and harried them, and stopped them from being able to show up at a point that would have saved them, and basically armed the werewolves with another tribe. And instead, the very worst thing happened. Well, these ghosts, frustration leads to a point, but you have to admit, they're not here because they got killed, those ghosts. They're here because, what do the werewolves bring? It's an end to a 50,000 history.
Mm-hmm.
Pentex is here. strip mining. We're moving, like, the gold rush happened here in Australia, and it doubled the population as their biggest city, right? Going from like 400,000, more than doubled to like 1.5 million back in those times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they talk about in the book how at face value, Australia didn't have a lot to offer until people started finding mines. And when you go through that geography section and every protectorate, it's always like mines, gold mines, copper mines, silver mines, uranium mines, all the way down.
Now, and that's the important thing. Basically, they found land, greed got a hold of them, and the worm doesn't need to come here.
Mm-hmm.
It's already here in their own people who refuse to see it. And so they're choosing to go at the werewolves who are at their worst, it seems. That's their purpose. It's what's triggering them. And they can't let go because the lesson wasn't learned, i.e. their sacrifice was in vain.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't for any purpose. And so they almost are a reaction for the land to go through, meaning that your best intentions as werewolves who believe... Because you've got to remember, when the Silverfangs came here, they said clearly the Bunyip are too weak to defend it.
Mm-hmm.
They can't defend their side. They can't do anything with it. They don't even show up. So we'll just take it all from them since it's open and available. And we'll go through and that's that. And they ignore the spirits who don't want them there or repulsed by them. They force those spirits to do with their bidding. They force them to teach them gifts or turn them into fetishes. Who's the worst villain here? You look at the Black Sprout dancers and they're wondering just who's going to come over to dance next.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're opening a club. So many people are turning to the worm, right? By how that reads. That's how the stage is set for this book. Many interesting characters in it. Case in point, we'll give one. I'd say it's our favorite, arguably. We were talking about, we were laughing so long. Mother Pasta.
Mother Pasta. All right. So Mother Pasta, I'm going to steal this one from you. She is, to give you a little bit of a background info, the Silverfangs are no longer the kings of Australia. Instead, there is a Guru Council, right? It's got a name. It's a name I can't pronounce, so I'm just going to refer to it as the Jelly Bean Council from this point forward. All right. So every tribe has someone that sits on this Jelly Bean Council, and for the Bone Gnawers, it's Mama Pasta. Now, Bob's died, folks. Anyway, for most of her existence, like her time on there, she's actually been pretty level-headed. She's the stuff of nightmares. Like, do you remember that book series, Scary Tales to Tell in the Dark? You know what I'm talking about?
I do. Yeah. I absolutely do.
She looks like they hired that artist for her picture, right? Scares me every time I look at it. However, her husband passed away a couple of years ago, and in her grief, she's discovered that she has an undeniable urge to eat the flesh of children?
Yeah. Yeah, I heard this happens, that when a wife who's in love with her husband loses her husband, she has to eat humans. It's the only thing, though, that'll keep her sated at that point. It's a tragic thing. It's one thing we don't like talking about in the States, especially. Typically, it's Catholics only, Roman Catholics. That's why a Mother Pasta. Yeah. That's what happens. It's probably all the carbs. You need the protein to wash your mouth. I have no idea. It's one of the weirdest things I've read. And it made me laugh. Not that you need a reason. Right? If you're going to create a villain, create a villain. But that's one of them. It happened and you're like, oh. So, by the way, the phrase you're trying to not pronounce is the... What do you call it? The Jelly Bean Council?
Yeah, the Jelly Bean Council.
It's the Jinda Bean Council.
Now, you have to admit, as funny as it is what I'm saying, it's also pretty close.
I understand. Is this a thank God for Mississippi moment? I just want to make sure that's it. I mean, I stand by it, but Jelly Bean Council's funny. We can roll with that. But it's the Jinda Bean, as we're referring to here, for purposes and reasons, right? As in, just because it's culturally different and our Western brain has issues pronouncing it, that's not what it is. Why I say it like that, Bretron, is because we got to remember, we'll give a head nod to the various totems. You have to go through here and get that Australian flavor. This mm-hmm. book is great for that. I told you, it's about that alien nation feeling that's just weird. But you got people or creatures in here like the totem Nigaliad is one of them. They draw it, and it shows like something looks like a spirit floating ahead with these withered arms, skinless, and its lungs are sitting on the outside that's still attached to a tongue.
That's the rainbow serpent?
No. It's just the Gilead. It's weird. It's another spirit. This is an honored spirit of theirs, right, in terms of the role as guardian. And that's what they have in your hair, and that's how it's drawn. And I was like, that's trippy. And you'll see it. It's in the book. You can check it out and go through it. I was like, okay, well, we'll leave your... That's, I don't know what it does, right? Other than that would terrify me to see it. It's not the only spirit that would do that. However, an unsung spirit, told you we mentioned it, we'll get back to it, that everyone needs to know. Forget Fenris. You need a war totem? You don't grab Fenris. You don't grab any Great Wolf in the Wood, whatever war totem you want. Don't grab Lion. You grab Piggy Billa.
Piggy Billa. Yes.
That's who you grab. The Echidna. You pick him up. I'm telling you, every time or every chance I get, I'm going to grab Piggy Billa because it's the cutest totem I've ever seen. This guy is like, he's got like a lizard tongue.
Is that, and okay, like a near, hold on. Is that his tongue or did he just eat a rat and that's its tail hanging out?
I'll give you either one. Creative interpretation, right? He's got like these wide eyes and a sure smile like, yeah, I got it. You want to fight? You're next. He's got these cute little claws that are there and he's got the porcupine quills off the back and he's the kid. He's Piggy Billa. It's that simple. He gets it done. He's known for being stubborn.
Mm-hmm.
That's enough for a war totem. I tend to agree, right? This has got an ounce of quit in him. And you know what? He likes menaces, right? That's what it is. And if you're a non-menace follower, you can't ever ridicule or ostracize menace guru. There's nothing wrong with him, right? You got to remember, they come from that culture where all are equal in spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important. However, then they have the great kangaroo. Yungar, the kangaroo.
This has got to be my favorite picture in this whole book, because it's a picture of a kangaroo, but like the sun's behind him, so like half of his body is covered in shadow. Like he looks like a frame out of a Batman comic.
It's Yungar will mess you up. Right? That's what. Look at that pose. Yungar standing there, like, you think I won't?
I like how he's flexing.
His chest is swole. He's worked out for days, like for the pose for this picture, right? The right amount of water content, let alone his legs. We know these legs would mess you up. He ain't that punk kangaroo from YouTube that was messing with that dog, get punched by owner and like backed up.
And he just froze. Yeah.
Yungar would have jacked that dude. He got beat 8 ways from something. Yungar, I'm just saying, don't sleep on him.
He looks like he's looking for that guy that punched the kangaroo.
He heard him a story. He about to correct it for everybody, right? Try Jesus.
Don't try Yungar.
Don't try Yungar because he fights, right? That's how they go. Because
he throws hands.
It's a good thing. But I adore this book for a lot of reasons that are weird and are not normal. And like mm-hmm. I said in the beginning, this is still holding a place for weird, right? I can't say it enough. Not just for the cultural parts in it, but this book holds a lot of tragedy with a potentiality for a lot of fun because there's a lot of plot seeds where players can make a difference.
Mm.
That's the part I'll get serious on. I think it's this open-ended and this dark history, dark moments. Here's the waning council, the weaknesses of the tribes that are here, the racism that's still prevalent, the non-racism that's here, the misunderstanding of who might be that way, the hate. The Calamity Worm could exist and thrive here, but yet doesn't quite thrive here. The Weaver isn't an enemy, but Pentex is mm-hmm. in the backdrop. There's a lot here where a player pack can come start a campaign. Clean shop. That's how you want to write a book, I think, for Werewolf, to be honest, is that you write in enough interest to hold trigger passions, open your eyes, have a friend correct you in front of everybody on his own podcast. You know,
is that what I meant?
All this stuff. All this stuff can happen. I bless you, man. I appreciate you. It teaches one to be humble. And that's it. And if I'm nothing, if not that. So that's a thing to do. But we didn't mention a lot of the guru in here.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I want to point out some stuff, some controversial things that could stop you. Case in point, get a Fenris in here again, and they put them back in that place that feels like they're always in the way they're written this time, where the get a Fenris apparently are all racist. And instead of this time saying that it was just a camp that was a part of it, they actually full-on say that the Get Offenders here support neo-Nazis and skinheads and a specific like alt-right-esque movement, but for the era that's in there that I can't recall. And I'm going to say, you know, all that's terrible, all that's jacked, and it's wrong, and it's inappropriate, and that's true. Except they also wrote in here something that you would have to read to understand. Their Sept Alpha hates them. Hates them. And it made me wonder just how many people... Because whenever you hear someone's from Australia, right? Two things I've noticed that happen here in the States, and it's weird to me that it does. The first thing is, oh, you're from Australia? Cool. No problem. I said, no, I'm Southern Australia. Why is there a distinction?
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
Right? Like I've heard that phrase. I'm like, well, why would that be there? And then they talk and backpedal and say some stuff, and they kind of squirrel away on it. And then someone explained to me that there's groups of people who have started up factions, and some of these factions have interesting keywords to be passive aggressive about their racism. Right? That distinctly don't like Aborigines or something like that, or, you know, but, you know, we have a problem with Africans, just the black people on this continent. Which, if you're any human being, you're like, what?
Mm-hmm.
How did you develop a distinction out of that or whatever? And it's not that it's every time, but it's... I had one person actually sit down and seriously talk to me about that, thinking that it was okay they had a problem with Aborigines, but not African-Americans or Africans, period. They're okay with them. They don't know them. But over there, they're a problem. And I was like, ah, man, that's just therapy I can't give.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I think this book is great at pointing it out, right? As the Geta Fenris go, you have those Get to come over thinking they know some type of way of how it's supposed to go. They don't like their Sept Alpha because she should be chiming in. She's literally the epitome of what they believe is this Aryan super being, right? And so they're like, yeah, Sept leader sits in the Jindabyne Council as us, and her name's Carla Grimson. That's purity. Absolutely, she could sit there. And actually, when you read her background, she's from Australia. Who cares about her attributes? She has no problem with the Aborigines and feels they have equal rights, if not more so, than anybody who's on the continent. And she'd love nothing more than to go trash these Get that came over with her, but her hands are tied because if she starts doing that, her place in the council, oh man, it's a tribal thing.
Mm-hmm.
She has to try to correct them by example and from within, and has to wait for these groups to step too far to step out of line. And they're careful because they know she's like that. So intertribe-wise, they built this conflict that's there that, once again, is like a checkmate-esque thing. And it's shocking. That's shocking to see and read about. It's a thing, as I like to say there. And the only other distinction I'm going to point out here is, because I like to end it on a positive note.
Mm-hmm.
Brentron, what's the alarming trend of the Fianna there currently in Australia?
The alarming trend? That they're old? That there's like the...
Yeah.
Okay, now I'm sorry, I'm tracking. I was like, what? No, there's, for some reason, it's like, Fianna were here from like day one, but I feel like the ones that they describe at the end of this book were the ones that got off the boat originally, because like, yes. Flashing Claws, he looks like he's my great-great-great-grandfather. And that being said, I wouldn't try to take him in a fight. That guy can still throw down.
It's not like age is going to be a thing. Like, why are you hung up on it? Everywhere you see guru heroes are these young, robust, or even aged, and they're like your elders or in your 50s or 60s mm-hmm. or whatever are doing it. This dude's like 95. Another dude's like over 100. Both of them will mop the floor with any of your crew.
Yeah.
Right? And one guy is going to have you hold his cane while he beats your ass.
Right? Like, this makes me question. Like, I remember reading somewhere, and maybe I made it up. Correct me if I did. Gru don't get to grow old, right? Because, you know, war, constant fighting almost. But
you're not
like,
wrong.
Yeah.
You read that in the life expectancy. It might have been even the updated book where they talk about the fact that, in particular, Arun, they're mm-hmm. not looking to die old. That's not a way to go out. And that, you know, you don't suffer the old, you know, don't tend thy sickness, am I right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things. However, there ain't no sickness in these two.
No. No, not at all.
They're like old coffin nails. Like, bring it. I, you know what? They're the epitome of, if you can't hold the torch, then why am I passing it?
Right. That's, it's like, what he it does is. Pass it off. The person that picks it up, like, falls down. He can't pick it up. He has to deadlift it up.
And as a good note, if you're looking for where they came up with all those lovely characters for the Rage card game they used to have, the ancient one, some of you may still have it. I know I did for a time. I found them again online to buy them for our friends to play. It was a good time to go back in the Way Machine and play a card game. But you got to understand that some of those characters are here. And to read the history that they had for them, pretty cool to do it. So it's worth that pickup to look through to do it. And I'm thinking of all the stuff here as I'm looking at notes that I didn't get to. because, you know, that, you know, trying Jesus. but anyway, the Great Barrier Reef is mentioned here because of the Rokea. I think it's the first mention of them, really, to get serious on. And Rokea are here, and it's a blurb, and it's showing that they're about to open up stories with them and, you know, changing breed books coming and whatnot. And I enjoy them. They're were-sharks. And they talk about how one Uktena, who's basically dances with body lotion, should be his deed name. Because all he does is go up and down the coast, enjoying the waves around Australia, loving that suntan.
Was he the one that stole the surfboard?
Yeah. Yeah. Right, so he gets sucked out to the ocean, and then he finds himself on an island, and this shark, it's this massive shark comes surging towards the shore and turns into a person and just doesn't say anything. He's like, hey, what's going on? And just grabs the surfboard and goes back into the ocean. Doesn't say a word. And I'm like, do you feel sometimes that maybe you need to quit? You just need to give it up. It's one of those things. It's one of those things. I thought it was awesome. But, folks, if you actually got anything else, Brent Shrine, that's all the things I can remember throwing in the last digs here. And Raids Across Australia is a worth book to read, to spee if you want to have it in somewhere different that your players maybe don't know and have mastered. Unique place. They do have excerpts about vampires in here, too. Saracens mentioned briefly, very briefly. No stats, folks, no city builder. It is a rage book. But gives an idea of the history and how they were utilized. You know, we went over a little bit of that dealing with the cocaine stuff. And there's more than that, of course. But a lot of detail we didn't get to. And I highly recommend that you go through it if you want to run your Chronicle and that accordingly. So, Brent Shrine, once again, thank you.
Yeah.
I have to go before I get mauled by a crack fiend, our cat, who has become unruly once again. So I will we'll talk to all of you later. Thanks.
See everyone.
Thank you for listening to our 25 Years of Vampire the Masquerade podcast. If you liked what you heard, please reach out and let us know on Twitter at 25 Years of VTM, at our email, info@25yearsvtm.com, on Facebook at www.facebook.com/25yearsvtm, or on our website, www.25yearsvtm.com. If you would like to support us, we can be found at patreon.com/25yearsofvampirethemasquerade.